hit me to move.
No, it's either
next to the right there. That's it's running now.
Yeah. So just begin, Oliver, if you can, by sort of giving me a little bit of biographical information about you, your background, where you're educated, your occupation.
Yeah. So my name is Oliver Johnson. I'm a doctor. I trained at King's College London as a medical student and studied London Health for a bit. And then when I graduated, I went straight on to faculty at the London School. So I never worked as a doctor. I worked as a academic, mostly teaching.
When did you graduate?
That was 2010. And I went straight up to faculty teaching global health, which included a bit about infectious disease, not a lot. Most of my teaching was on health systems, health policy. And then I did that job and helped King's to develop a Centre for Global Health and its thinking around global health across King's College London and the South London Teaching Hospitals, so collectively King's Health Partners.
Can I ask you quickly why global health? What was the passion?
Yeah, it was always the first interest from when I went into medicine was, you know, I travelled a lot as a kid, I wanted to do an international career, I was quite committed to work, I wanted it to be work that I would feel really passionate about, and, you know, a bit of a science background, so it's
Can I ask you a question? It might sound odd or pedantic. What do you understand by the phrase global?
So it's a very good question. I've published some papers on this question, so I'll try and give you a brief answer. I think the definition I usually use is both to say that global is around its being interdisciplinary, so it's a sense of holistic. And that means bringing in not just the clinical and public health sides, the traditional, like all sort of epidemiology, traditional public health, but also economics and anthropology and engineering and lots of disciplines that relate to health. So there's a global sort of a globalism in there. There's also the global as in international. And I think the distinction with international is global implies that actually national borders are not very important anymore, and nation states are actually not very important anymore when it comes to health. They're only one player, as opposed to the determining factor. So I think when you say international health, you're really talking about the sort of 1950s, you know, rather, you know, divided up. Whereas I think global really implies a much more 21st century understanding of, you know, how, be it diseases, and a good example of that, or technology, or communications, and everything else kind of goes beyond that. So it's coupling both of those things together for me, and both of them are interesting. I'm very interested in the non-clinical parts of health, and I'm interested in the international side.
I'll tell you the reason I asked you that question. So one of the questions that's running through the study, one of the questions I have, is it was very quick, the book was very quickly framed as a crisis for global health inequalities.
Yeah.
So, like devil's advocate, my question is, was it really a crisis for global health, or something very bad future?
I think, my short answer would be it was a crisis that had the potential to be global. Ultimately, it was global in the sense that whilst there were not many cases outside of West Africa, it had a profound impact on populations outside of West Africa. And so health systems, you know, the NHS, every doctor in the UK was worrying about Ebola. They were thinking about Ebola. They were being trained. They were stocking up on PPE. Now, even if none of those hospitals saw an Ebola case, or only two or three of them ultimately would have seen an Ebola case, there's A, the sense that there was still a response in the UK in preparation for that, but B, also the sense that this could have been much worse, and I think the fact that in Texas and in Spain there were these infections is a sign that we are not as... We all thought that there was no possibility of disease transmission in the West. Now, I think what we do know is our public health systems are strong enough that we can chase down potential cases so quickly that we can stop an outbreak in its tracks. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that there won't be some limited spread with, you know, I think it really is a disease that captures the public imagination in terms of fear. So I think it was a, you know, and you look at the extent, you know, the range of global institutions that were involved in this at the highest level. So it wasn't just DFID, it was the Prime Minister, it was the head of the WHO, it was the head of the UN, it was Barack Obama. So it got onto the agenda at the very highest level of the G7. So it was more non-West African institutions and non-specialist organisations made this a high priority, which again I think puts it in a slightly different context. So I think it was global. And I hope we learn some lessons from this, you know, which we'll come on to.
Sorry, I rather interrupted what you were saying. So you were
tidying up my biography.
Yeah, let's go back to that. So after you started teaching at
I was working strategically at King's as well as teaching, and I took on a second job in the British Parliament where I was director of the All Party Public Health, so I was policy director for Lower Health, working a lot with a guy called Nigel Crisp, who was a former NHS GP, a whole series of MPs and peers. And so had this policy and academic background. And whilst I was doing that, I started planning this project. So I'd come out here first as a medical student in 2009 on my elective to work at the Children's Hospital. But at that stage, I was already pretty focused on global health, and I'd had a reasonable amount of training, so I was quite an applied elective. And when I went back to King's, where we'd worked in northern Somalia, Somaliland, for the previous 15 years, we said, well, why don't we work in another country? We have the capacity to do more. And I said, well, Sierra Leone would make a lot of sense. It's English speaking, it's got a British model health system, it's, you know, we have a big link in South London with the diaspora and with Sierra Leone. There are probably 25,000 Sierra Leoneans just in Lambeth and Southern Southwark around King's. So it's a sort of second home for a lot of Sierra Leoneans. So Camberwell, Peckham, people here can name street names and they'll tell you they live for 10 years in the next door house. Yeah. So there is this connection. So started coming out with the former dean of the medical degree program and the surgeon who was head of global health at King's. Won a small grant, a different grant, to start a partnership with the medical school, and I was able to convince them to just let me come out here funded by King's with no particular remit except to try and build a partnership that, you know, King's felt had potential. So quite an important bolster for King's was letting me come out in the first place. I was on my own, and then I had a few friends who were taking time out and came as unpaid volunteers. They funded their own flights. We got a small donation to put £500 towards their flights each, and they came out here and worked in the accident emergency department. They worked in the ministry, and that sort of started. We started fleshing out with ministry, with partners here, what a partnership could look like, getting a bit more funding. And so by about March 2014, which is when the first case appeared in Guinea, there was about six of us, including a nurse, a couple of doctors, a pharmacist, someone like me, more of a kind of policy type, quietly working away at some long-term capacity building, long-term development. We really did no clinical work, By very good fortune for us, we had just recruited in March 2014 a new clinical lead, so a new kind of lead doctor, who replaced the junior doctor and was in fact an infectious diseases consultant from Spain,
right,
who had worked in East Africa and trained in tropical medicine, including in Ebola.
Oh, right.
By complete good luck. And I think she came out a week before the first case in Guinea for a year. Her name's Dr. Marta Lano.
Marta Lano.
And alongside that, a former very senior physician and guy's assistant to the London, Terry Gibson, had just retired and decided to come out here for a year, largely on his own back, but linked to us. As a general medical consultant in Connaught on the wards. So suddenly we had significantly more senior clinical firepower on our team, as well as I say, this kind of broader range of people. We had an infectious disease advisor in the UK who worked at the Royal Free Hospital, was working linked to the VHF unit at the Royal Free,
right.
So knew quite a lot and knew a lot of people and had some relevant training who was able to come out and advise us. So in March we were brought in to advising the government on the case management side of Ebola, so the clinical and the patient side.
You're jumping over our material. So obviously you know in March that the reports of Ebola are good.
Yep.
Are you at that stage between March and May when an actual person has arrived?
Yep.
Thinking it might come or you...
Yes. So, I mean, within days, the minister had been working at State House with a point person for the cholera outbreak previously, when there was a major cholera outbreak in Sierra Leone, and the former Minister of Health, Mia Kakavo, and there was a sort of inactive cholera task force that brought together ministry with key NGO partners. And basically, and we all thought there might be cholera season coming up, so this group still sort of existed, although largely mothballed because not much happened. But she learned a lot about NGO coordination from that experience, and so that very quickly she reactivated that as an Ebola task force. And so it meant that within days of the first case in Guinea, there had been a meeting chaired by her with WHO, MSF, partners like King's, Save the Children, you know, a whole range of people from the Ministry of Health, in a room together, starting to talk and to set up subcommittees looking at the clinical side, looking at the surveillance side, looking at public health information and education.
This was March.
March 2014, we had the first meeting.
That
was at the Ministry of Health, chaired by the Minister herself, with... So, yeah, WHO, most of the big NGOs, so the Red Cross would have been there, Médecins Sans Frontières, Save the Children, we were there as King's, and then a whole range of traditional NGOs, GOAL, IRC, you know, the traditional players, with international agencies. So UNICEF would have been there, UNFPA would have been there, WHO, I was there. This is Marta, who I just mentioned as our...
Hello, how are you?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I think that history of what happened in the outbreak, so I'm just...
Wow. That's a longer story.
Sorry. We've got to March 2014 so far, so Marta knows that means we've got 4 hours.
Oh, no, it's okay, yeah. We still have 1 year. Look, can I ask before?
Yeah.
Apparently these people from the environment...
Yeah, so...
Yeah. So it's an auspicious start.
Yeah.
It's got all the right people in the room. Problem is, not very many people know very much about Ebola. In that room, there are very, very few doctors. So I'm very lucky. I have Martha sitting next to me, who is an infectious disease consultant, but she's probably the most senior doctor in infectious diseases in the room, if not the country, at that time. Because no one else has an infectious disease clinician. People have public health people. But when it comes to, okay, what is PPE? And what does it matter if you have a visor or a goggles? At that time, there were very few people who had the, you know, and the ministry has a lot of doctors, but most of them are mainly from a public health background. They've worked as district medical officers. They know a lot about health management and around surveillance and things. But
so how do you characterize them? They might need to do or what they thought their possible actions at that point.
So there was sort of a bit of a disconnect between a big plans. You know, there's definitely a recognition that there could be cases in Sierra Leone. No expectation that it could be huge at this stage. We're thinking there could be a small rural outbreak, you know, in one district. If we're not careful, it could spread to a second district and there could be another 20 cases.
Right.
It would be awful if there was a case in Freetown. We must avoid that. But everyone's saying there's never been a major urban outbreak. WHO is saying, everyone's saying, MSF, confidently, there's never been a major urban outbreak of Ebola. Ebola doesn't cause major urban outbreaks. There is no risk of this. And you're already starting to see attention early on where WHO is saying, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. Don't quarantine, don't close your borders. Whatever you do, you know, there's not much to worry about here, guys. We're on top of it. And someone coming in from WHO saying, Minister, this is the best prepared country with the Kenemalassa Fever Center. There's no country in Africa that's better prepared. You know, we're going to have enough stocks of PPE. We're going to do it. It's all fine. I'm almost narrating word for word what they were saying in these meetings.
So I think that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this was early on when Kenema had this Lassa Fever Centre of 20 beds, and we thought we were going to see, you know, 30, 40 patients. But, you know, and they weren't wrong. We had a diagnostic lab at Kenema for viral hemorrhagic fever that was very easy to convert into Ebola. So they weren't wrong that we had a good lab, but I think there was a underestimation of how quickly this could spread to overwhelm that very limited capacity, I think. And so you have the WHO being quite relaxed, you have MSF not saying much, but when they do it tends to be straight to the international media and saying things like, quite early on, and probably May, you know, this is out of control. and then you have a lot of tension in the room whereby, you know, people are taking MSF to task and saying, you know, who's this saying is out of control, we've got it under control, everything's fine. And I think that was both, you know, the ministry and WHO who were working very closely, the UN family, and then you've got MSF as a bit of an outlier, you know, talking of sporadically, not in a very consistent way, and often not in the meetings. They're talking at, from HQ level on the media, but it's getting back to people that this could get really, really bad. But no one really believes them. Everyone thinks MSF's just, you know, scaremongering. Most of the organisations just don't know. You know, they're doing small rural health programmes. They're not epidemiologists. They're not infectious disease doctors. So they're sitting there thinking, like, you know, they're only able to apply a bit of public health and common sense.
What were you thinking?
We were thinking that we were underprepared. In particular, we were concerned that there was a massive implementation gap. So, you know, people, the minister and people in the meeting are saying, we need to do big, you know, big things. We need every hospital to have an isolation room. Case management group don't often do that. Case management group come together, but case management group is one man, the director of hospitals for ministry, with no one from WHO was present. So it was King's. And we're a capacity building, we're a British university who's never seen an Ebola patient in our life, but we're there.
Yeah.
You've got Emergency, the Italian NGO, there, and you've got the country director of MSF, some, you know, in attendance. But it's sort of four of us, and then a small paediatrics NGO, sometimes five of us sitting there, and saying, right, we need to set up, we have no budget, we need to set it up an isolation unit in every hospital in the country and train everybody. Does anyone have a list of the hospitals in Sierra Leone? No. Okay. Right. Let's start writing a list of how many hospitals there are in Sierra Leone. So we're starting, but we're all country directors. You know, I as King didn't have any resorts really. So I martyr on it full time. But it's one person and it's a country. Other organisations just don't have any capacity. Ministry has very little capacity. So we're sitting there and, you know, after this initial surge of sort of initial meetings in March, by the end of April, early May, people are starting to say, oh, it's in Nigeria, it's in Guinea, but we've done such a good job. We've dodged a bullet. And I had, you know, it's for early May, I think, when we started saying, maybe Sierra Leone had no cases. Maybe we, you know, Liberia and Guinea didn't look too bad at this stage. And we're thinking, wow, maybe we've done such a, you know, and I remember I was in a conversation with you, we should publish an article on what we did in Sierra Leone that stopped us having a case. And I said, guys, let's hold off on that publication until it's done. But I remember, yeah, I mean, but I remember we had that conversation. But at the same time, I think there was a real sense of unease. I think we were, you know, we had these rather bizarre meetings. I remember just sitting, you know, especially in May when the first cases appeared. And, you know, they said, oh, there's seven cases, but we're not sure where they are right now. And we were sort of looking at each other thinking, this is a huge deal. To not know where these cases are, you know, this is out. Well, no, the first seven cases were up in Khai Laon, and they broke out of the peripheral health unit.
Okay.
Their families rioted. They broke out the peripheral health unit, and they smuggled them into different homes in the community in rural Khai Laon. And ministry can't get there because the local villages, this is an opposition stronghold, lots of suspicion, everyone's a bit panicked about what they've heard in Guinea. So, right, the first cases were thought to be cholera cases. It was only in day two that people said, hang on, because the samples went to the lab in Freetown for cholera testing. And it was started doing cholera testing and said, hang on, maybe these are Ebola samples. So, the first cases were in Khai Laon. They came to Freetown for cholera testing.
They this is really fascinating. So there were seven cases there, and they were being held as suspected cholera. And you said they broke out.
They broke out the peripheral health unit, or they left, or whatever. And, you know, people tried to go and try and find them. But already, you know, we're starting to sit there, and everyone's looking, you know, the WHO is quite relaxed. And we're starting to put our hands up and say, hang on. You know, we're not experts, you know, we're feeling like we ought to defer to people who are, but at the same time, this doesn't. And we're sitting in the meetings going, does this feel right to you? But at the same time, you know, we're trying to, we as King's being very, very respectful of media, so we're not doing any media at all at this stage.
Right.
We're trying to support the ministry, and you know, we probably aren't being pushy. And I, you know, on the flip side, in terms of underestimating, I remember an early meeting where, you know, and this probably was in March, where we had a meeting of that case management group, and someone said, we need to buy an ambulance for every district in the country. And I said, that's completely ridiculous. What a waste of money. What on earth are we going to need an ambulance in every district of the country for? Because this is a context where there was no money in the health system. And where, you know, Ebola, we're thinking we might have 20 cases, or 30 cases, but to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on ambulances, you know, when we have some ambulances in the country, you know, and when people in our A&E are dying every few minutes because they can't afford a $2 antibiotic. So I'm sitting there thinking, and it suddenly comes up with a budget of $20 million. And I remember thinking, $20 million? $20 million? And this, you know, so, you know, and I think I'm finding it, a lot of us who are in the development, you know, we're development professionals, suddenly finding ourselves at the beginning of the humanitarian outbreak, humanitarian context, and probably are finding it hard to make that transition of saying, actually, money isn't a problem anymore, let's spend it, which goes completely against how impoverished. I mean, we had zero money as kings. The hospital had no money. We, you know, $1,000 was a big amount of money then. So the financial side, but also in terms of being a bit more assertive, it takes us a long time to start actually being quite assertive with partners, government partners and others, and saying, you know, this is now an issue of our staff safety. We don't agree with you. We can't accept that. You know, we can't, we're going to push for that. So I'm saying
things. At this point, you are actually starting to think about the safety.
We're starting to think, you know, we've got a medical students out here on their elective, they're still here, but we're starting to get people in London saying, shouldn't we start to, you know, scale down our staff? And I'm saying, no, 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 it'll be right, we'll, you know, let's keep an eye on it, watch for waiting. So, I'm...
At this point, yeah, we know, has it got to Kenema yet?
So this has sort of got to, this is sort of May, it's got to Kai Laon, very quickly it starts to get to Kenema. And patients start to be referred to Kenema.
Just because it's very important. Now, I've got all the Kenema, but is there a moment between all these people responding and being into cholera before the outbreak of Kenema, where they do, very officially, as I decided, diagnose the first Ebola case at the last unit in Kenema?
So, that's correct. That's correct. But though that sample had first gone to Freetown for cholera testing, but Freetown couldn't do Ebola testing.
They
didn't know what they were handling, and it was, you know, but I don't think they ever did the test, but I think before they'd done it, but, you know, this was early beginnings of rainy season, you know, and the response was, you know, everyone's been trained in cholera, so, you know, it's only about 24 hours before they, you know, switch gear. But so they will have sent those samples then to Kenema. They'll have diagnosed the first patients in Kai Laon. Already at Connaught though, we had an isolation unit here, 2 beds, and we'd started seeing suspected cases. Now one of them tested negative. So we set it up in April. We started seeing patients in April, but they just didn't have Ebola. But as a precaution, we had a unit.
You said it wasn't Ebola.
It was a holding unit. So the idea is every hospital in the country, this was a plan at the time, and it's a plan, it's still now, it's just rebranded 15 times in the transition. But the plan is that every hospital needs to be able to screen every patient that comes in, and if a patient meets a case definition, they need to be able to safely isolate the patient, send blood at the time to Kenema for testing, and if they test positive, send the patient in an ambulance to Kenema. So this is a plan in late March, early April. King's sets up with Connaught a unit here, the military set up their unit very effectively, 34 military, emergency set up a unit, but really nowhere else does it properly. And
then you're saying that already in April you had some patients?
We had some patients, but they all were chronic HIV or other things, but, you know, a patient with, we're being cautious, and so we have a poster up on the wall that says if you have a fever and you've had recent travel history to Kai Laon, and you've got diarrhea, we have to isolate you and test you. And there are one or two patients that meet the case definition, and we test them, and, you know. So we have a 2-bed unit in the middle of our A&E department. It's literally a room with 2 beds in it. No, none of the other structures, and that's where we first started seeing patients. So, probably sometime in June, Marta can give you the exact date, probably June. Their first case in Freetown, I think, was at a nearby clinic, Macaulay Street, and I think within 10 days, a week, that first case in Freetown. It's a government clinic. I think that was the first case. Someone came in, denied any travel history, ended up on the general wards at Macaulay, M-A-C-A-U-L-E-Y, Macaulay Street. And that's where we have our first, that I remember, our first case. So we're starting to see patients, and there's a night in probably June. And I don't remember whether we'd seen our first positive case yet. I suspect not. I'm sure we hadn't. But we had two suspected patients at the same time. And we had two beds. And now suddenly we don't have any extra beds for any new patients. And A&E's heaving. And we think, crikey, we've underestimated this. So in one night, it was a fairly epic night. We start about 6 p.m. and we work through till 11 o'clock or something. The head of ICU, some random cleaners, our consultant, a few of us roll up our sleeves, shut down half of the emergency department, scrub it clean, and turn it into a 9-bed unit. And there's this one night where we had two suspected, we're doing this because next door we've got two suspected patients.
Yeah.
Suddenly, there's a third suspected patient in A&E, we have a bed for them. And then that same night, at about 10 o'clock, someone comes up to me and says, we've got a patient from Crewe Bay, which is the slum next door, with watery diarrhea, we think it's cholera. And I'm thinking, you've got to be kidding me, because the other half of the A&E department was designated as the emergency cholera unit.
Maybe we're going to have two outbreaks.
Maybe we're going to have two outbreaks at the same time, and I'm going to have to run two different infectious disease units in parallel. So this is, that night, I'm starting, my blood pressure starting to go up. And so, but this is, as I say, even though they turn out to be negative, those patients, we are still assuming that they are positive and wearing full PPE and building a bigger unit around it. So our 2-bed unit becomes a 6-bed unit and then a 9-bed unit, and bit by bit, from that point onwards, and from our first case in June, we continually have patients in that unit. So you can't send in a builder. You know, so how do you expand your unit? How do you fix a tap? You can't. So we're massively constrained in this space about what we can do, because we'd like to be able to put in sinks and drains and this and that, but we can't because it's already open. So we go and it gently basically grows and grows, but by mid to late July, we're seeing quite a lot of isolated cases. It's pretty clunky. Dr. Madupe Cole is the consultant physician in charge of the unit. After a lot of convincing, he agrees to do it. With great bravery, he agrees to be the doctor. He'll go in and see patients in this unit, wear his PPE. You're trained M-O-D-U-P-E-H. Yeah, Cole, C-O-L-E. And he's the consultant physician. He's one of three consultant physicians. He's got infectious disease interest. He agrees to be the head of the unit here at Connaught. King's is playing a support role.
Yep.
But everything we do through Connaught. We're taking a very backseat role. We're still development mindset. But, you know, and not, we have some clinicians, but normally they're not doing clinical work. They're doing training and other things. But we're starting to have to go in and see the patients a bit, because Dr. Cole will go in, but junior doctors are anxious, and so Marta's going in, and others are starting to go in, and we're starting to make a transition. And then pretty suddenly, in late July, early August, you turn into a new phase of collapse. And at this point, I should say, we were seeing what was happening in Monrovia. And we were seeing Monrovia implode.
They're a little bit ahead.
Yeah. They're ahead. And it was when we start to see a significant number of cases in Monrovia, we think, we've got this completely wrong. And that's the point when Monrovia starts to get bad that we realise that there can be a major urban outbreak. There may well be a major urban outbreak in Freetown. That we are completely unprepared for this. We go to, you know, try and get together £7,000 of funding to bring out two infectious disease specialists to set up 10 isolation units in Freetown. We can't get £8,000, we can't do it. We couldn't do it, couldn't get the money. Couldn't scrape together the money for the flights for volunteer infectious disease specialists to come out for a month and to help set up isolation units around Freetown, because at this point the money's not flowing, and if it's flowing, it's flowing in a very awkward fashion that doesn't go to organisations like King's. We can't get a penny. Diffit mainly. So we. They said. Yeah. But they're saying, we're really sympathetic, guys, but we don't have a mechanism to give out £8,000. You know, we've given £5 million to UNICEF, or whatever it was, but we, you know, we've transferred the cholera budget, and we've told them they can reuse the cholera money for Ebola, or whatever it is, and we're working on a budget plan, but at this point, the donors haven't got the fear yet, frankly.
Right.
They're concerned. They're sitting in meetings saying, guys, this is worrying, but they're not, you know, throwing up the rule book. They're not, you know, they're not tearing that up and doing, you know, so suddenly in a few things happen. Dr. Madubikol gets infected in late July. He's the first infection in our unit. He's the only infection in our unit till about November. So, and this causes a cascade, and also Dr. Khan, the head of the unit in Kenema. And all this time, you know, we're hearing horror stories from Monroe, we're hearing horror stories from Kenema. So we're sending our samples up to Kenema, we're sending our positive patients up to Kenema. And at 8 hours in the car, you know, well, probably not, probably 6 hours, but a long time. And we're speaking to colleagues up there from the WHO. And, you know, we have colleagues from the media and things going up there saying, there's a horror story, they say, what's going on there? And we're calling them up and saying, we've got one more patient, can they take them? And they say, we don't have any beds, but we'll take them for you, because we know we're the only unit in the country. And it's our job. And so, you know, a whole series of, we're just sending patients up to Kenema, sending samples up to Kenema.
That's part of the problem in terms of other people actors not getting is that it's still not highly visible.
It's in the east. Kai Laon is a opposition, you know, the government doesn't know Kai Laon very well, because it's, you know your own areas. This government knows the north well, because that's where most of them come from. So, you know, we're having some interesting conversations in this task force, but there's one guy from Kai Laon in the room, Sierra Leonean, who say, are starting to talk about the different links to Guinea and the roads, but everyone's saying, what's the quality of the roads like in Kai Laon? You know, what is this? You know, and someone can answer the question, but it's not at people's fingertips, because it is another part of the country, and it feels very far away. So we've helped support setting up other isolation units in Freetown. You know, some people have been sent to Kenema for training, they've been given a box of PPE, they've designated a space, but they're not nearly ready. In the same way as this hospital in Texas was really nearly ready. You know, at the end of the day, very few units really are ready to handle an Ebola case safely. And these units are not ready. And the only units that are ready, as I say, are those 34 military Conom and emergency, really, at this stage.
Are you getting any help from them, sir?
Very, very little. They deliver a tent that can be used at one site. They join us in inspecting one or two sites. They are contributing to discussions once or twice a week at meetings on designing a handbook guideline for hospitals, but that's it. So they're not present in case management. They don't have any clinicians apart from this deployment up at Kenema, which is from a different arm. That's the GoOn network. It's not WHO Sierra Leone. They are, frankly, we're struggling a bit. You know, they're working on some surveillance, but they're in their own closed door meetings of ministry mostly, and occasionally they sort of, you know, not having a lot of contact. If we're having contact, we're talking about other non-Ebola things, because we were still doing non-Ebola work at the time.
What about the health medicine in the African Archipelago? I've been asking about this issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, ministry was a very political place at the time. There was clearly a lot of different. There was not great communication within the ministry. There were some different camps, different power bases, different opinions. So there are parts of the ministry that support the minister, but there are some parts that are, you know, I think they would say the minister has excluded them. The minister would say that they were trying to undermine her, I would guess. So you've got this tension going on, which means that she's being quite assertive,
mm-hmm.
and some people are getting rubbed up the wrong way, but she's being quite, you know, businesslike.
Do you think the fact that she's a woman has...
I
made it difficult for
her? The fact that she's a woman, the fact that she's young, the fact that she's not a doctor, the fact that she's got a bit of when she speaks in English, she's got a bit of American accent, she's got an American link. Some people say that she's...
Everyone they replace at the top level is a diaspora.
Yeah, but they all have trouble with this.
Yeah.
They have trouble, you know, working the old boys network. Right. None of it helps, you know. There's people who say that she's, you know, got personal next president, but she's from the opposition, or she's not real, truly APC. Okay. Right. See, what I, you know, that's why I'm here. I mean,
this is what you've picked up.
This is what I picked up. So, you've got difference. You've got a group of people who are saying the ministers, not including them in the ministry. They're saying that the ministers being too strong-handed. She's sort of publicly up, you know, dressing people down. And you've got people saying that she's micromanaging. You've got other people saying, well, she's having to micromanage because no one's doing what she's telling them to do because they're trying to resist her role. You know, who are saying she's just showing integrity and good, you know.
Right.
Yes, she's telling people off, but she's telling people off because they're not doing a good job. So, you know, I think...
well, we don't know. This is hearsay, but it's really interesting. That's what people say.
But it's definitely the case that you've got, you know, this all going on. Mm. And so, and in a Western area, the response is a bit of a mess, frankly. There is not clear. Mm. You know, Western area is incredibly complex. You've got a lot of big hospitals. There isn't. This is above and beyond the district medical officer's role or capacity. It's, you know, it's a big thing. Connaught doesn't report to the district, it's a national hospital. You know, you've got 34 Ministry, 34 Military doesn't report, Emergency doesn't report. So a lot of the players aren't part of the district structures. And lots of the guys at Ministry are so worried about and focused on Freetown, they're getting personally involved. But it means that you've got this sort of murky, who's in charge here situation a little bit.
Right.
And then suddenly in August, everything, there's a sort of run on the banks equivalent. An explosion in the outbreak and a collapse of confidence. So you've got simultaneously outbreak in Freetown. Very quickly, you're beginning to realise is out of control. In as much as we are no longer able to contact trace fast enough, we're starting to see random patients coming in who deny contact, who are testing positive, as opposed to a situation where every patient has a discernible epidemiological link to another known case, which would be my kind of definition of when things are getting out of control. So we're starting to see that. Dr. Cobbett can't die, so suddenly, in August, I think maybe Dr. Cobbett was very late July, you have to check, but I think
it was completely.
Very late July, and Dr. Vodubikov comes quickly after that. So you're getting a collapse of confidence, junior doctors are on strike, they don't feel safe, senior doctors are slightly afraid of, you know, being exposed clinically because they're saying their colleagues are getting sick and they're, you know. Meanwhile, what else are we seeing? Flights being cancelled. Everyone's pulling out. NGO's pulling out. Everyone's starting to be pulled out. BA's cancelled. Air France. You know, a whole load of the. You know, Royal Air keeps going, but a whole load of. Kenya Airways pretty quickly stops. So you've got this cascade, and NGO's pulling out, and, you know, all this is happening simultaneously, and this is the point where we as King say, right, change of tack. You know, Dr. Hunt dies, and we say, okay, we're going to have to do step into the breach here. If Sierra Leonean doctors can keep the rest of the hospital open, we're going to recognise that Sierra Leonean doctors probably aren't going to be willing, they don't feel confident, they don't feel trained to go, they don't feel like if they get sick, they're going to get good enough care. They're saying, it's fine for you, you're being medevaced. We're not going to get medevaced. We're going to die like Dr. Cole did, you know, in a tent somewhere. So for a whole period of reasons, the King says, okay, we'll take over the Ebola unit. We're going to run it. And we're going to, you know, clinically manage it. And we're not going to expect civilian doctors to go inside anymore. And I think really from the time Dr. Cole dies till now, civilian doctors have not been...
In order to do that, I mean, that's a decision. You can't make that on your own here. That has to be made in London, right?
So it was more that it's a decision for the head of the hospital to allow us to do it. Simultaneously, I'm having some increasingly tense conversations with London, who are supportive but, you know, understandably concerned.
Are you worried about, I mean, are you covered medically? Would you be backed out?
We are covered medically, but we are urgently checking and we're thinking it's all right for the Brits because the British Army will sort us out. We've seen what's happened with Will Pooley
late
August. You know, we know Will already. We knew him before he went up to Kenema. So we have a bit more confidence that there's a British response, but Marta's not British, Marta's Spanish. And our nurse is American. And we're starting to think, hang on, what about everybody else?
Yeah, right.
So at this point, it all starts, you know, and all the hospitals are shutting across the city. So Connaught stays open just by the skin of its teeth. But there are strikes, you know, nurse strikes, junior doctor strikes, senior doctors are anxious about being really exposed clinically, they stop doing elective surgery. Children's Hospital closes for maybe 2.5 months completely. This hospital that should be full. Most, if not all, of the small hospitals close, and frankly, most of them aren't open still. And yet, there is no response. MSF aren't here. MSF are 9 hours away, including Kailaun.
Yeah, they're still up in Kailaun.
And that's a long, long, long way away. Yeah. And Red Cross are talking about it, but they're saying it's going to take them months to build somewhere up in Kenema. And that's it. And so, Mark, you know, we as kings are on absolutely a knife edge of being evacuated. And
in August.
In August. And we end up, most of the team going back to the UK, bar Marta. And I have urgent meetings with the UK team, the head of Kings and others, and we convince back in London, and we convince them to allow the team to come back. So a week later I come back and I get the green light to recruit fast. You know, I've now got different saying to me, blank check, what do you need? How do you need it? Like, you know,
where is it? That's important. So how have they suddenly found a way of faster?
So I don't know how it worked in London, but they brought two people out. A guy called Chris Lewis, who's a different health advisor, comes out.
Yeah.
So he's been given an authorization to, you know, start to, you know, at this point, the British government realises, they've seen what's happened on Monrovia, there's been a shift in thinking, it's now got to Downing Street, it's got to Secretary of State's level. They're told to, you know, mechanisms are kicking it in. Chris comes out, they deploy a guy called Peter Rees-Gildea, who is a humanitarian consultant, basically, who's brought in by DFID in probably early August for DFID. He's the guy who starts going around to people and saying, right, what can you do? How can you scale up? How big can you go? How fast can you do? What do you need? Let's make this happen. And he's saying to me, you know, can you open up this many units? Can I give you $1 million? And I'm saying, a month ago, I needed 8,000. I can't possibly give a million. Will you give me 200? Saying, no, you need to do more, you need to do faster. But he's going into the room saying, what's his name? Peter Rees-Gildea. And he's saying, guys, what can you do fast to open up beds? What can we do? And he's saying this to a room full of NGOs, and the NGOs are saying, well, we'll do public health messaging. He's saying, no, I want clinicians. And they're saying, we're not clinical NGOs. Or they're saying, we're not Ebola. It's too high risk. Our head officers won't let us. So all the bit, you know, no one now is there. I mean, literally no one.
Mm-hmm.
You've got emergency, but they're still doing, they've got a 2-bed unit just for, in Laka, just for their surgical, they keep the surgical services going. This is before they've opened their holding unit at Laka.
Mm-hmm.
So they've just got their general surgical trauma hospital, where they've got 2 beds for their own patients. That's all they've got. 34 military's got 10 beds, we've got ours, and then the nearest thing is in Kenema. And so we start just, it's, you know,
is this
it's nuts.
When you get drawn out actually into becoming involved clinically yourself?
Now? I'm getting involved clinically. There's only me and Marta and one nurse, and we have only one or two Sierra Leonean staff, and we've got up to 23 patients who need round-the-clock care. A lot of them are extremely sick. We've got, you know, you go into our unit, and you'll find in the morning, and you'll find that everybody in one of the rooms has died. You'll find 6 dead bodies. You know, they're coming in very late. They're coming in very sick. We are all, you know, literally just trying to safely isolate and feed these patients and give them some paracetamol and give them some ORS is beyond our staffing. You know, and meanwhile we've got all these national meetings to advise nationally because. You know, we're being asked, how, you know, and then we're being asked, can't you open up a unit at Macaulay Street, at Macoupa, at Lumley, at these other hospitals? So in September, already, we're starting to see, even, you know, it's about safe isolation. the highest quality of clinical care will come as and when we've got the staff, but right now it's about outbreak control, it's about safe isolation, it's about stopping health workers dying, it's about stopping the disease spreading, it's about dignity for patients, and we've got to get in as many patients as we can, and we've got to open up as many beds elsewhere. So we start going to all these different hospitals where we were in June, which have imploded, and saying, right, we need to reopen these, but we need to properly this time, we're going to deploy teams. So pretty, we start opening unit, you know, a unit every 2 weeks, you know, and we open up. So Lumley, first discussion about reopening it to having its first patient in 6 days, and we've got building teams working through the night, we're training them on live, we're, you know, and yeah, that's it still, you know. Government's opened peace training school, 34 military are doing their bit, so the Sierra Leone Army is doing their bit, King's is doing our bit, and it's still Kerry Town's miles away. Lacca opens, but it's got 8 holding beds or something, and 10 treatment beds, which is filled in about half an hour,
right.
And then it's full.
Right.
And their doctor in charge gets sick very early on, and so they take a bit of a hit early on, who's one of our closest colleagues. And at this point, we start to know a lot of people who are sick. So, Sierra Leoneans, you know, we knew Dr. Khan, we were at meetings with him, he's died, Dr. Cole's died. The doctor at emergency has just been medevaced, Will's been medevaced. Another doctor from Kenema gets medevaced, you know, through Connaught, we're looking after this friend. You know, so it's starting to feel very, very, very close, and starting to feel very real, and we're thinking, you know, we're assuming it's a matter of time, you know, we're seeing everyone else get affected by it. And then, you know, September goes and we're just getting hammered. So we've got patients collapsed inside that hallway inside the hospital because there aren't enough beds. We haven't got those tents yet outside the hospital. And you just pick your way over the bodies in order to get out of the hospital. And we keep saying, we cannot be more full than we can be full. We cannot become like Ken, and we cannot become overwhelmed. So we're getting huge tension from some parts of government. We're having to be very assertive because they're saying we've got 60, 90, 100 patients waiting in the community needing isolation. Connaught has to take more patients. And we're saying we have 16, we've got 21 patients with our 16 beds. We can only take as many as we can take. If you start putting them in the wards, we're going to get sick. You'll have no unit. So these tensions are there. At the same time, in August, we say you need a command centre. We need a command centre, so we go in with the AGI, the District Health Management Teams, before the British Army were involved. We set up the command centre, it's a room, and it's mainly around ambulances and bed capacity, because what we realise early on is that Connaught's full, and we've got 20 patients outside the gates, and we're completely, you know, an ambulance will pull in, you're expecting one patient, you've got one bed, and 8 sick family members will walk out the back of the ambulance, or will not walk out, will have to be carried out the back of the ambulance. And, you know, and this is it, and I'm supposed to be coordinating this, and I'm in full PPE because I've only got 2 of us down there, and I'm trying to juggle the 2. And then we suddenly hear that there's 8 empty beds at 34 military, but no one knew.
Right.
Because no one's got eyes on it. So we set up, and we really, you know, again, we're quite assertive, but we set up.
So, what strikes me as you're telling us is that you're coordinating this, never the ministry at this point.
So, ministry, you know, they've got a case management group that is meeting, you know, but they are trying to coordinate the whole country. They're trying to open up PTS. They're getting called to State House every day. They've got to go on a trip. The president's going to come out, and they're going to come out in 2 days. And they're not clinicians, so they're doing assessments, but they're not, you know, they're not clinicians. They're public health doctors. They're not putting on PPE. So the reality is we're having to step in. And you know, you say, well, the director of hospitals is sorting out, but the director of hospitals is one man. You know, it's one man, and so.
Where do you decide to make the
call? It's located in the district health management team as a district medical officer initially.
So
the DHMT office. There's one in every district. The one in Western Area is down near Old Fort Bay College in Calabar Town. Is it in Calabar Town or is it in? It's just basically near Kissy. And that's where. We open it up, and I just send Amar from my team, who is a theatre manager from the UK. He's come out on a career break, and is doing a bit of teaching in schools. And I say to come and work for me. So she starts doing house-to-house sensitization for the Red Cross. And Anna say to her, "You need to run an ambulance system. I can't help you, because the traffic's so bad, it takes an hour and a half to get to. It's not that far, but it's a long way away. I need to pick you up, and I need to put you in, and you need to set up an ambulance system and a patient tracking system.
Yeah.
You need to monitor bed management.
Yeah.
And she you know, is working 7 a.m. till 10 p.m. for 2 months solidly. And politics is challenging there. Not everyone likes the fact that, you know, we're, and you know, there's a lot of pressure when there's a body on the street to get them picked up first and taken into a hospital. But we're sitting there saying there are no empty beds, and actually, we've got a very, very highly suspicious patient quarantined in a house with 30 people that has got to take higher priority. And a vagrant on the street who's very likely to have Ebola that some minister or the president's seen out the window of their car. That's, you know, so there's political pressures on people to say, why aren't these people being collected off the street, or why aren't whatever, you know? But at the same time, we're saying epidemiologically, that's not what makes sense, and we're having their attentions on this one, and I can understand the pressure they're under, and I can understand why the president is picking up the phone. I'm not saying it's the president, but whoever it is, someone senior in government is picking up, because they're seeing people on the street, and they're saying, this isn't what's supposed to be happening. But the reality is, there just are not enough beds, by far there are not enough beds. And we have beds empty for 20 minutes before the next patient is on them. So somebody dies, or someone's discharged, and we have 5 minutes to clean up the bed before we get another patient in.
Right.
And so we're setting up the command centre. The British Army then comes in, they move it to the British Council, and they set up then this massive command centre. And our role is really around kind of the clinical patient coordination. But by this point, the British Army are doing burials, which we're nothing to do with, and doing surveillance. So it becomes a much bigger thing. But
it's where the British Army come in, the British Council, that whole command centre.
That whole command set up. But we have staff in there, and we are doing the patient part. You know, and we, with AGI, which is the Tony Blair Group, who are an important player because they also transition, they almost evacuate, they decide not to, and they transition their governance team into a Ebola project management team. And this is the point, and this is, you know, one of the things that we're pushing, that even now is a hard thing for people to understand. People keep talking about bed numbers. And as we've learned from the NHS, where we've got some hospitals we're running as kings, it's not about bed numbers, it's about turnaround times, it's about throughput.
Yeah.
And we're trying to tell people, stop telling me you're building 100 beds, tell me what your throughput is going to be. So how many patients can you see a day? That's the number I'm interested in. And if you can have a 50-bed unit that can see patients twice as fast, that's a hell of a lot better to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing we're saying it on the media. At this point, we're big on the media. I'm doing podcasts, I'm doing Al Jazeera, Martyrs on the front page of Spanish newspapers. And we're saying how out of control it is, but we're also saying it's
so we're in September now.
Yeah, and we are working a lot with Donal Brown. Chris Whitty at DFID.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in London in October, and I fly back with the Secretary of State, so we're briefing DFID quite a lot, because they recognise that we're the ones most at the sharp edge on the ground, who can say things as they are. And we keep saying, better to have 10 beds today than 100 beds in a month, because this is an exponential increase in cases.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't translate. So we're saying we'll set up a treatment centre, but we'll do it tomorrow. We will set up, you know, at one point we were going to set up Dewey Hospital. We were going to open it up in 12 days as a 64-bed treatment centre. This is in late August, early September. You know, we're offering to run Hastings Airfield. We're, you know, it keeps falling through because of all this politics. It keeps getting delayed. But we say we don't need chlorine on tap. We don't need 2 months. We just need some tents and we'll do this, but we've got to get these patients out of their homes. But you know, then, you know, our staffing goes up. We have all these units, they're completely under pressure until late November, early December, and then suddenly, you know, the other beds kick in almost at once. And suddenly you've got Goderich and Hastings and PTS2 and Kerrytown and Hastings Airfield and Kissy from MSF, and suddenly, late December, we go from being overwhelmed to suddenly on Christmas Day having, as you like, sort of day, 2 patients. Until probably the 10th, 15th of December, we had not had an empty bed since August.
Since August.
You know, and then suddenly, on Christmas Day, there's a half-hour window when our unit is empty. So suddenly, phase 3 comes in, and now we're very much on post-Ebola, and it's saying, Ebola can go to Kerrytown, but how do we get this hospital reopened? Because actually, more people have probably died from other things than Ebola than from Ebola. because all these hospitals have been shut. Children's hospital has been closed for 2 months. You know, all these different hospitals are closed. So now, this is where we are now, where we're saying, right, it's about the immediate restoration of the health system. It's about the longer term reconstruction, and it's about how we do that safely. And that's what, you know, becomes our focus. And, you know, having played a very active role in the British response and the government response, the Castilian government response, by late November there suddenly so many infectious disease doctors and so many epidemiologists and DFID have all their own advisors and they've got their head around it, so we're so we are. So we've seen in that unit about 1,300 suspected cases, of which about 800 have tested positive in the 16 about, I think, I don't know, we do have the exact figures, say 700, say roughly 700 to 800 patients have tested positive in a 16-bed unit. And if you'd asked me at the beginning, I would sort of say, worst case scenario, we see 20 cases. And that's what we built it for, really, 20 cases.
So, what are the lessons left?
I think most people say the critical point in these outbreaks that turned the corner, you know, what turned the corner in Monrovia? It was the Ugandans who came in and they set up a warehouse and they admitted 80 patients in the first 36 hours and they just got the patients into beds. And it's what we were saying, you know, and, you know, sometimes I think maybe if I were to do things differently, I would offer King's in July to open up a warehouse with 100 beds with two doctors.
Just a warehouse?
Just a warehouse. So, we were talking about it, but there was all this politics. I said, the stadium, I was just like, put up like these rock walls, these things that fall through broken, these massive tents, and saying, shut down the stadium, put two of these things up, let's just get patients into them.
Well, actually, that's what we're civil defence planning
UK space in forever. Yeah, but don't touch the football stadium. Don't touch the football stadium in Sierra Leone. It wasn't. So, what's the learning?
But did you actually think, did anyone think that thought?
Yeah. And to be fair to their own government, you know, you've got the government saying, stop building purpose-built greenfield sites, take over a school. We've got a school here. DFID, can't you just convert the school? But DFID in London has decided it's setting up these 7,100-bed units based on the MSF model of tents. And, you know, ultimately they do that. They support King's to do that, and they support, you know, Donal hears this and starts transitioning, but it's a bit late actually, and we could have done it a lot earlier. And so it's a few things. It's just get patients out their homes into safe isolation fast. Now, there are lots of cases where that was done badly. Either lots of patients who didn't have Ebola getting into a really bad unit. So you've got to have some rigour, which is where the army's pretty good at infection control. But also you've got to make sure that you don't have masses of health worker infections, so you've got to, you know. So it's not to say just anybody throw open anything, but it's to say a small professional team can open up a big unit, and yes, maybe not every patient will have IV, but you'll stop this outbreak in its tracks, and that'll save a lot more lives. You've got to get a patient out of the community. Command and control, that command and control system was essential. And it worked well, and I'm really proud of it. And I think we did know that because we set it up in August. I think the lesson is, you know, do that at the beginning, and particularly look at, you need good operational data. So we're about to publish a paper saying, you look at what was delaying patients getting through our units. You know, at one point it was labs, at one point it was ambulance capacity, at one point it was treatment beds, different things were blockages in the pathway. You need to do the critical path. You need to talk about throughput. Not just bed numbers. Bed numbers don't mean anything. And for that, you need good operational data. And then you need a team of people who can respond to that operational data and say, okay, we can see that we've solved one bottleneck, let's create a new one, let's throw resources at it. I think, you know, Sierra Leone Army has been extraordinary. They've done an amazing job, and their ability to respond rapidly in a large scale way, and we, you know, arguably could have, I don't know, they, yeah, I think, you know, I think DFID has used them more, I think that it has used them a lot, but I think that, you know, they probably, yeah, we could have probably early on used them more, because they were quite disciplined, and not waited for Save the Children as much, who never really wanted to do this in the first place. I think lessons are you've just the release of funding. If we'd had £8,000 early on, we've got to have a mechanism for getting funding out the door. A willingness to, you know, we were sitting there. I remember these very explicit conversations I had, and this is a criticism of me partly in one of my learnings, where I'd say, they would say, you don't get urban outbreaks in Ebola. And I said, oh, that's interesting, why not? And they said, well, we don't really know, but it just doesn't happen. And I say, oh, well, these people sound like they know what they're talking about, I'll believe them, rather than saying, that doesn't make any sense at all. Like, so I think being...
So failure to really question the supposed effects.
Yeah, exactly, and being a bit enthralled of that. And I think, you know, everyone's enthralled of the MSF PPE standards and things like this. And actually, what you need someone to come and say, how is this disease transmitted? What makes sense? What is safe? Not, do we have the same make and model of mask that MSF say they need to have so that we can say we meet MSF standards, which is what gummed up the international response for such a long time. So everyone's saying British units have to meet MSF standards, they can't meet WHO standards, they've got to have the hood and the cape and the mask and the second mask and the, you know, and we don't have, we're not, King's isn't using any of this stuff. King's is saying, we're happy with a, you know, we understand this disease, it's not airborne, you know, we will use what we're said provided it's safe. But a lot of organisations and the British Whitehall team are getting themselves tied up in knots, UK Med, saying, well, no, this PPE doesn't meet this requirement. And you're thinking, hang on, you know, on based on what? You know, but it all gets tied up into different standards because everyone's sort of terrified, you know.
I'm really interested in this thing about experts saying just don't get urban outbreaks over.
Yeah.
Because, just come back to that. So I think, so for instance, Peter Piot has been talking about this being an event that could have been predicted or foreseen.
Yeah.
There's a sense now in this globalized world.
Yeah.
We become very conscious of risks, maybe.
Yeah.
But we only know the risks we know.
Yeah, the unknown unknown kind of situation. I think, you know, I would agree with Peter in as much as we've never knowingly seen Ebola in West Africa before. There probably has been a bit of Ebola before, but we never knew that's what it was, and we got lucky before. So Ebola, you know, if you'd said to me, because we used to have conversations, it seems quite, you know, now, but a year ago.
Well, can I just go?
We're just talking about, we've predicted this. You know, a year ago I was sitting there saying, what would happen? You know, we were doing a bit of work with Partners in Health, who were in Haiti when the earthquake happened, and they had a development team, and suddenly they're in the middle of an earthquake, and I'm saying, guys, what are we going to do, you know, if there's an earthquake in Freetown? Because we don't do clinical work, we're not set up to do it, but if it happens, we know that we're going to get sucked into it. And everyone's saying, well, it's never going to happen. That's not what we're up for. And I was like, okay. But on my list, so we were sort of having these rather surreal conversations, but on my list, okay, so it would be an earthquake, on a fault line, flooding, maybe some kind of civil emergency. Ebola would not have made my top 50. You know, Ebola doesn't exist. It's a Uganda-Congo thing, you know? So, you know, in as much as Ebola itself kind of came out of nowhere, at the same time, I think we ought to, by March, April, this ought to have been, we knew enough then, once it got taken hold in Guinea, and we could see that it was taking hold in Guinea, and we hadn't nailed it, and it had spread to Liberia, and the moment it spread to Liberia, you know, but this is early on, this is April time, this should have been alarm bells. You know, it's all over the papers, so it's not that they don't know this is happening, but there should have been alarm bells in with all of these people. Margaret Chan should have been here. In fact, she should have come once in the last 10 months to West Africa herself. That would have been some example of leadership from the WHO, which has been wholly lacking. So on some level, the WHO should have taken this seriously, and I think that they have, apart from one or two individuals, who have been great individuals, who've done their best. As an institution, I would say that it has consistently and overwhelmingly failed throughout this outbreak.
Has she not been to West Africa?
To my knowledge, I don't think that Margaret Chan has been to West Africa. Ban Ki-moon has been to Sierra Leone.
Right.
I don't think I've ever heard her. I've heard Barack Obama speak on Ebola. I've heard, you know, I've never heard.
Well, she has spoken. Yeah.
She's done interviews. And she's done, but this is the biggest public health crisis of the last however many decades. Where is the WHO Geneva should have moved to Sierra Leone? This, where, you know, and ultimately their senior people started to come out in October, but in April, we knew enough that CDC, DFID, WHO, UNICEF at the very highest levels ought to have been, you know, ought to have been seeing red flags. And certainly when MSF, the head of MSF globally, does a major press release saying Ebola is out of control, you know, this is the world's most specialist agency in Ebola, is the most experienced, and they're publicly saying, you know, that this is out of control. You can't say we didn't have some warning signs, and it was not that hard to respond. For us as kings, what do we, people say, well, we're a health NGO, but we're not a humanitarian NGO, we know about cholera, but we don't know. What does kings know about any of these things? What does emergency, the surgical trauma hospital know? What does Sierra Leone Armed Forces know? What do the partners that were actually here on the ground? It was it's simply a factor of too much was led from offices in London, New York, you know, Washington, Paris, where people were afraid and decided to kind of sit it out, rather than people here in the field saying, what can we do to get stuck in? Ebola isn't that different to cholera at the end of the day. You know, like, it's an infectious disease, it's mainly spread through, you know, diarrhea and vomiting. Yes, we need higher standards of PPE, but at the end of the day, we're not, this isn't beyond the, it's to an edge of, but not out of the range of these things. So I don't think we should let ourselves off the hook. And I think I, any of us, as any of us involved in the response at any stage who were or should have been involved, we as the UK government, we as the international WHO, you know, this should never have happened. It was wholly avoidable. It was avoidable in May. Even now, the contact tracing, you know, these sorts of things, it's not as crisp. And, you know, even now I just find myself thinking, how on earth is it kings? It's like, you know, how does it, even now it feels like. So I think that...
Was it a failure of
global? Yeah. I mean, I feel like it was an enormous failure of global health. I think it was a failure of the institutions we rely on to recognise that there was a scale of the problem, to be able to show leadership, to cut through red tape, to sort it out. Some institutions, you know, DFID, I think, was slow to respond, but actually the JITAF structure was surprisingly well coordinated, and I think, you know, genuinely, Donal and their health advisor Susan and others, Chris Whitty, you know, they were out here, they were burning midnight oil, they rolled up their sleeves, they owned the problem, and they threw, you know, my car broke down, so Donal lent me his car because I needed a car for a couple of, you know, we didn't have the right registration to buy a car, so David had lent us a car, you know, they ripped up the rule book on multiple occasions to make stuff happen from about September. But it was, for the learning for DFID is two things, one of which is, why didn't we start doing this in April? And the second of which is, they are used to basically giving out money. They discovered here that basically we had to nationalise the Ebola response. We sent in the army, we sent in the NHS, and we sent in DFID to solve all these problems. But the NGOs we normally rely on, and the UN agencies, couldn't get their stuff together. They were, you know. So DFID is used to saying, here's a check, someone go do this. MSF was saying, we're at capacity. Red Cross says, we're at capacity. And everyone else says, we don't have Ebola, until very late in the game when suddenly everyone, you know, in about November time, gets interested. So, you know, I think as we are much more vulnerable than we think, you know, things can spread faster, we don't pick up at them fast enough, but we privatised humanitarian aid, and if the NGOs don't want to play ball, the UK government is left holding the can. So either they need NGOs that are willing to do this space, get into this sort of riskier space and respond quickly in medical terms, or they need to nationalise and say, the UK Army is going to know how to do this, but of course the UK Army, apart from Kerry Town, doesn't treat patients even here. So They're not allowed off base.
Last question. We began this discussion with this rather academic definition, but how can you draw a distinction between what used to be international health in the 19th and 20th century?
Yeah.
What you just described at the end, having voters actually national institutions in the UK and even the American type of the US, doesn't that look very much like the old colonial international health?
Yeah. I think the my definition of global health is not that a definition of the architecture as it is, it's a definition of the problem as it is. Mm-hmm. Problems require interdisciplinary solutions, but that doesn't mean currently we have the capacity to safely, effectively tackle global health problems. I think it's absolutely an indictment of our, the WHO is frankly too enthralled of member states, and it's too hammed up by bureaucracy to be it's not a global institution.
Right.
It is led by nation states. They don't do anything that national governments aren't willing to do. They do everything through the World Health Assembly.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a very tentative body, and it's not an organization that is set up with the leadership to take tough decisions and say, actually, we need to intervene for the sake of the world's health in this problem.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it says, our mandate is only to support national governments where they ask for help. So,
it's reactive,
but it's also entirely dependent on the nation state structure.
Right.
And then, I think there are one or two players. Most of the players, the Cubans, the Chinese, the British, the Americans, the French, are all nation states, so they're funded in that way. So I would agree that architecture is like that. But you've got a few examples, and I think King's happens to be DFID funded, but we weren't at the start of this. And I think that's a somewhat global, is that the very fact that you've got a British university here on the ground in Sierra Leone, working in partnership, recognising that it's in our own interests as in the UK as well, to then understand that, I think that's pretty global. And, we weren't part of a national response.
Okay, this is a nice time to
Yeah.
Thank you, Gavin.